normal.
All right, so we kind of ended last week. We'll kind of pick up, if you'll remember, which I think is kind of... So if you'll remember, David had a prayer that one of his advisors that we discovered was Bathsheba's grandfather, was a man by the name of Ahithophel. So Ahithophel was evidently a very, very intelligent. It never says that he was a prophet or spoke to God, but they said his words, you know, sometimes seem like that. So he was a very, very smart person. So when Absalom's rebellion started, and I guess the theme of last week was like, so David did something obviously horrific, and God forgave him, which we can all seek forgiveness, but there's still going to be ramifications. There's still going to be that boat wake of life that carries through. So I don't know if that led to some guilt in David's life where he felt like he couldn't judge his kids or take control of his kids, that because he had done something so horrendous. But his family just seems like they got very, very dysfunctional. So his one son kills his oldest son, who was actually the heir to the throne, takes off. His mother's from another kingdom, which was really forbidden. And then David, for some reason, really, really pines after this son. And I don't know if it's a case of... And I know some of us have gone through, you know, children where we don't know where they stand with the Lord sometimes, and that makes, as a parent, that is truly a heartache, is the thought of your child perishing and not knowing the Lord. So I don't know if that was a theory put through. If I was trying to, like, Google, or not Google, I use other search engines, but why David just had such a thing for Absalom that we'll see, you know, what the fruit of that is. So in the midst of that, this guy Ahithophel is given, you know, Absalom's rebellion takes fruit. David has to flee. David leaves some guys behind, trying to muddy the water. And again, back to David's prayer was, make the counsel of Ahithophel like that of a fool. And it's kind of funny, I told you I confessed and I kind of pray that we're supposed to pray for our leaders, but I don't necessarily have to pray for those who counsel him. So my prayer is always, hey, make the leader of this country, make those advise him his, like, the counsel of Ahithophel. Well, I kind of think that bared fruit this week.
I know, I have to get out of my prayer.
So that somebody counseled somebody to go before an audience, and obviously, I don't know if it was what the reasoning was, but it didn't turn out well, which was, so all you can do as a Christian and pay that people see it. Now, how they handle that, there are people that will deny. I mean, we have people that can't tell whether they're a guy or a girl now. So obviously, people can deny any facts they want to and twist life to fit their narrative. But we saw in this case that Ahithophel gave really, really good counsel of probably what should have happened. He would have overtaken David and the people that were traveling with him. They were tired. They hadn't eaten. Most of them, if you'll remember, didn't even have shoes. They're just fleeing. And Ahithophel said, hey, grab a bunch of people. Go right now while he's tired and attack. Well, David had left someone to muddy the water, and his counsel was like, oh no, man, they're tired, they'll be like, you know, honey badgers, they'll just, you know, fight everybody to the death, and it'll be bloody, and it'll be gory. He said, wait, call all of Israel to you, which I'm sure tickled Absalom's ears that he was going to get, you know, he's absconded with the kingdom, and now he's going to get, you know, his head puffed up in the fact that everybody's going to show up and fight for him. And so what happens is he eventually accepts that counsel, hey, I'll wait for everybody to get here, and then I'll go after David, which, you know, we saw spies that went to David and told him, hey, you need to get across the river and get on the other side by morning. So the outcome of this basically is Ahithophel realizes he's kind of been thwarted, and this, so it's been about 4 years, I think, since the whole Bathsheba incident, and he is, that was what this whole portion of the story about is, like, harboring hatred and who it really destroys. So it made Absalom a murderer and a usurper. It made, well, and there's a guy back in the Garden of Eden that kind of assumed that role a little bit. And it made Ahithophel, who was David's close advisor, and it turned him against him. So not dealing with that hatred. And, you know, I don't know, I'm bad about it somewhat to myself, so this is me pointing fingers at me. Sometimes you just got to let it go. You just, you know, move on, let it go. Life is only X long, and when you spend it, you know, you're just destroying yourself. You know, you're probably driving your blood pressure up and all kind of stuff. So that hatred, although in your mind you're going to get even with this person, is really mostly directed at you, mostly destroying you. And that was kind of what this point of the story was. So Ahithophel gets all his house in order, climbs on his donkey. And it's kind of interesting, I hadn't noticed this, but we'll see that play a role, which kind of means having a donkey was a very, you were in the upper crust of society. It was like the Tesla of its day. And you had to feed it to charge it. But, so he gets on his donkey, which obviously says he goes home, puts his house in order, and hangs himself. So his hatred eventually, and bitterness eventually, literally led to his own demise. And like I said, I if anybody was here last week, I looked it up. I was kind of surprised. I'm thinking that, you know, that's a really bad thing. But evidently under Jewish, the fact that he put his house in order allowed you to kind of, if you just got mad at everybody and went out and left everything in a mess and hung yourself, that was bad. But if you got your affairs in order and decided I don't want to go on, there was really no law against that. At least, you know, rabbinical teaching or whatever you want to, it just really wasn't specifically, again, we like see it as self-murder, therefore a violation of, and I don't know if that comes from the Catholic Church, you know, I know that's a big thing in the Catholic Church, I don't know if that's kind of bled through the history of Christianity, and I don't know if it's right. I obviously, when you've reached that point, you've kind of lost your thread with your Creator, and I'm sure it's not what He wants for your life. But that being said, so that's kind of where we'll pick up the story now. That
okay, Minnie and I were talking last week a little bit, and I know you were saying, like, David really didn't do anything, but on the other hand, and everything he did, even though we might not agree with this part, and maybe he didn't feel like he had a voice, but he still trusted the Lord and walked in humility, and where he went is actually important. The place, because it's where Jacob went when he was fleeing Laban, and that's where the angels met him. At the same time, you're going to see that David's met with provisions, but it's also a place called the camp of God. So it's kind of like he's going now. And Juice, if you get back and look at David, that's where he's going lost.
Well, it's kind of interesting because you think about Jacob, what had happened. He had deceived his brother, all this thing. He had caused all this turmoil, which in reality was the right thing. It was supposed to happen. He was prophesied to rule over his brother. But between him and his mother making that happen, whether the Lord... You know, you can't say whether that was the Lord's plan or whatever happened. He still created all this turmoil, and out of that, he had to flee for his life, and that's where God met him. But I have to strip you of all these things you're used to get, and it looks like in David's life, you're kind of seeing this point. He kind of reached this pinnacle in a couple of chapters where God says, I've given you rest from all your enemies.
Right.
And he comes up, you know, he solidifies this covenant with David. And that's the danger in our lives when you start taking that covenant relationship and it becomes slothfulness as opposed to resting in the Lord.
Yes.
You're still doing the Lord. And you don't see David. It never says that David consulted with God.
But you do see the
right
way he's interacting there, whether there's still a humility and we say, like, be encouraged. He's like, hey,
maybe it's what the Lord wants. And I'm saying that's almost like Jacob being stripped of all that, all the accoutrements of being king and living comfortably and, you know, all the wives and all that. It's just been stripped away because I need to get that out from between you and me, and I'm going to take you out to a place where I can deal with just you. Yeah, let's go camping. Me and you and Bigfoot.
Me and you and Bigfoot.
So,
they didn't have ever.
So, let me see. So that's Ahithophel. I hit the button. Oh, so there's Ahithophel at the bottom. So we're going to... And David went to Mahanaim with Absalom. This is verse 24, by the way. And crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. And Absalom had appointed Amasa over the army in place of Joab. And this is going to be kind of interesting. Just remember, I know it's hard to keep track of these names. Did I just do that again? Well, but you're going to see the same players kind of bounce back and forth in the middle of this, which is really interesting, but it's tough to keep track of. So Amasa was the son of Jether, an Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Naas, the sister of Zeruiah, the mother of Joab. So they're like cousins. His cousin is Joab, who's the head of David's army. And here Amasa is a cousin, and he's the head of Absalom's army. So the Israelites and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. And David came to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Nahash, from Rabbi of the Ammonites, and Merker, son of Amiel, from Lo-Debar, and Barzillai, the Gilead, from Roglim. I started to take the time to go through that and see what's in that, but I didn't, I have to confess. So they brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery, also brought wheat, barley, flour, roasted grains, beans, and lentils, honey and curds, sheep, cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat, for they said, the people have become exhausted and hungry and thirsty in the wilderness. So, again, back to Scott's point, it looks like the Lord has taken David from all his comfort zone, stripped him of all the things that would stand between him and his relationship with God, and then now God's provided for his needs. And who knows if that happens in our life. There's times when we're, you know, frustrated and mad with God because we're in some situation and something's happened to us, when all he's saying is, hey, you let a bunch of stuff get between us, and I'm going to remove some of that so I can come talk to you and deal with you. And it's painful. Obviously, David's been cursed at, called all kinds of names, slandered. His concubines, like his second-tier wives, I guess, have been, you know, humiliated in front of all of Israel. So David's in a real weird place, but everything else has been removed but his relationship. So on to chapter 18. So David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them the commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David sent out his troops, a third under the command of Joab, a third under Joab's brother Abishai, son of Zeruiah, and a third under Ittai the Gittite. And the king told the troops, "I myself will surely march out with you." But the men said, "You must not go. If we are forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. It would be better now for you to give us support from the city." So they're basically saying to David, you being king is why we're willing to stand with you. Because we feel like, you know, chances are they feel like he's the Lord's anointed, and they're willing to stand with David. And if the battle goes bad, they could just flee and people won't really bother with them because they're on the hunt for David. So they're asking David to stay behind. And it's kind of interesting if you remember when all the bad stuff started is because it was a time when the king should go out and fight, and David stayed behind and got himself in trouble. But this time they're saying, no, this is the right thing to do. And the king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, "Be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake." And all the troops heard the king's orders concerning Absalom to each of their commanders. So David made it a point to, right or wrong, for everybody to know what his wishes were. So David's army marched out of the city to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. There Israel's troops were routed by David's men, and the casualties that day were great, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the whole countryside, and the forest swallowed up more men that day than the sword. Now, Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding a mule. Again, the mule is kind of the symbol of being in the upper crust, and, you know, most other guys had to march into battle, you know, on your feet, and you were kind of tired when you got there. So getting to ride a mule or a donkey is a big deal. And as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's hair got caught in the tree, and he was left hanging in midair, while the mule he was riding on kept going. When one of the men saw what happened, he told Joab, "I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to the man who told him this, "What? You saw him. Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have had to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt." But the man replied, "Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed into my hand, I would not lay hand on the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai protect the young man Absalom for my sake." Anybody notice a kind of interesting dynamic there? Two times in David's story that people kill somebody and bring the crown, their head, different things to David, and David was always like, "I didn't tell you to do that." So this guy's pretty slick. He's like, "Nah, not for all the money and wherever, I ain't doing this. The king said don't do it."
And he was one of
David's
men that he was with for a while, that he saw that he was touched
off,
you know, no matter how much God delivered
him to his hand. So this guy's a pretty interesting character. And so he basically said, the king said no, and I'm not doing it. So, "And if I had put my life in jeopardy and nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me." So he basically says, hey, if I had killed him, and come back to you. And then the king said, why'd you do that? I'm going to put you to death. You wouldn't have stepped in to save me. You would have said, oh, sorry about your luck. Got my shekels back. So Joab said, I'm not going to wait like this for you. So he took three javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. You're going to see a couple verses here that I find kind of interesting in that sense. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Then Joab sounded the trumpet, and the troops stopped pursuing Israel, for Joab halted them. They took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest, and piled up a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. So the interesting thing is he took three spears, plunged them into Absalom's heart, but then it says 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. To kind of give you the impression that three spears didn't kill him. But I think what they're more saying that Joab's making this a group thing. Right, right. So everybody's got a little, I don't know if any of you work for a big company ever in your life, but usually meetings are just about spreading the guilt, right? So if I have a bunch of people in a meeting and we all agree and something goes wrong, I didn't say do it. Everybody agreed. We all did it. And usually companies don't want to go through and fire 10 people, so we just always laughed about that when I was coming up through the corporate world. So that seems to be kind of what happens here. So you're going to get interesting. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself, for he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. He named the pillar after himself and called it Absalom's monument to this day. So this is, he's taken the throne and he's like, I'm never going to have an heir. So I'm going to make myself, this is like the Nebuchadnezzar kind of thing, I'm going to build a monument to me so I can worship me. And you can worship me if you want to. So that's kind of what this is. And the reality of it is, although he built this little thing as an altar to himself and he gets thrown in a pit and covered up with rocks, is his final outcome. I got some stuff at the end to kind of, it's some interesting, I went out and kind of looked at that little scene, and we'll go back and play that. Now, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said, let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has vindicated in this day by delivering him from the hand of his enemies. You are not the one to take the news today, Joab told him. You may take the news another time, but you must not do so today because the king's son is dead. So he's basically saying, I think whoever's going to go and tell David that his son is dead is going to be in trouble. That David might not take that news lightly. So you're a good dude. I'm not sending you. We'll get a flunky. So Joab said to a Cushite, go tell, the guy didn't even get named. It's like a Star Trek episode, you know, with the guy gets the yellow, or one of the colored shirts always gets killed. And you never know his last name and stuff. So it just says, and a Cushite. Go to tell the king what you have seen. The Cushite bowed down before Joab and ran off. Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said to Joab, come what may, please let me run behind the Cushite. But Joab replied, my son, why do you want to go? You don't have any news that will bring you a reward. So he's basically like, this isn't going to go over well. I wish you would not go. So he said, and if you'll remember back in his other, that his son was evidently a very, very skilled runner. That he had, there was other examples of him running. So he just wants to run. Run, Forrest, run. And he said, come what may, I want to run. So Joab said, run. Then Ahimaaz ran away of the plain and outran the Cushite. While David was sitting between the inner and outer gates, the watchman went up from the roof of the gateway by the wall. As he looked out, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out to the king and reported it. The king said, if he is alone, he must have good news. And the runner came closer and closer. So I guess it was a thing. If you saw your whole army running back to the city, that was bad, bad news. Then you were in retreat. If they had sent just one guy back, that seemed to be good news. Then the watchman called and saw another runner, and he called down to the gatekeeper. Look, another man is running alone. The king said, he must be bringing good news, too. The watchman said, it seems to me that the first one runs like Ahimaaz, son of Zadok. He is a good man, the king said. He comes with good news. Then Ahimaaz called out to the king, all is well. He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up those who lifted their hands against the Lord my king. The king asked, is the young man Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me to your servant, but I don't know what it was. So he basically, I guess you could say he tells a lie, but he basically says, he's smart enough to say, I ain't the one telling him that. I'll let somebody else tell him that. And the king said, stand aside and wait here. So he stepped aside and stood there. Then the Cushite arrived and said, my lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has vindicated you today by delivering you from the hand of all those that rose up against you. And the king asked the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? And the Cushite replied, may the enemies of the Lord, my king, and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man. So I don't know if he didn't understand what he was doing, and that's why Joab picked him, because he's like, he wasn't at the meeting, so he doesn't know that David's not going to be happy with this. So, but he just delivers the news, and the king was shaken, and he went up to the room over the gateway and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. So again, I'm trying to discover why David has such an affinity for Absalom. You never really see in Scripture that he was like a great hunter, or he's an out. Like, we kind of got that with Ishmael. Esau. What's that?
He had good hair.
Maybe David liked his good hair. So that, it just doesn't seem to be, and the only thing, I mean, the closest thing I found to an answer here was back to what I was saying, that David knew that Absalom was not a believer, and that David knew that when he died, like, you'll remember when his child with Bathsheba, that he was, like, crying, and then when he just died, he got up and he said, I'll see him again. You know, I'm just going to have to go to him. He's not going to come to me. So he basically kind of, you know, that's somewhat where we get the feeling that children that haven't reached the age of accountability will be in heaven. And but here, David knows that Absalom has, I don't know this, but I'm just speculating that maybe David knows that now Absalom has gone to Sheol and not to a very good place. So that's why he's so shaken. So I went out and I found some kind of interesting things here. I'll go through them about this. So this poignant tale falls into three episodes, each with a point to make. Point one, David prepares his forces for battle. While David musters the troops, the main point of this introduction is to make transparently clear that he had nothing to do with the death of his son. David was not allowed to be present at the battle and pleads with Joab to deal gently with my boy Absalom, displaying his fatherly love for his rebellious son. So that's from the New Jewish Publication Society. Again, you're out just searching all kinds of stuff, trying to make sense of some of this. The forest battle, the forest and the battle. frame the scant account of the momentous battle for the rule of Israel. The text is relatively unconcerned with this outward set of circumstances, preferring to concentrate on the relationship between David and Absalom, despite the notice that David won. Point three, the forest devours. The Hebrew root translated claim actually means devoured. Absalom, symbolic representation abounds in this section besides the devouring of Absalom by the forest. So then I found a couple other things. Absalom's mount, a mule, is symbolic of royalty. And that's why I brought up the point with Ahithophel, that he was in the kings, he was part of the... So losing his mount symbolizes losing his kingship, which was kind of pretty short-lived. The form of the... So this gets into the tree thing. The form of the word translated thick branches that caught his head appears in Job 18:8, where it means net or mess, suggesting that Absalom's luxuriant hair and his vanity were at the root of his demise. So if you remember, he used to cut his hair once a year, and it weighed 10 pounds. Is that what we said? 9 or 10 pounds? Something like that. So I'm sure back to why you said David might love. So this was part of his personality and part of his vanity is the point they're making. And I also went up and looked in the red up there, if you can read it. I looked up Deuteronomy 21:23, which is quoted in the New Testament, that says, "Cursed is everyone hanged in a tree." So this is kind of the Lord basically... I'm again speculating that he used Absalom as a tool to bring David where he needed him to be, but Absalom had rebelled. And again, there's going to be ramifications for his... You might be forgiven, which he's never said that he's forgiven, but there's always going to be consequences. So, and that was the consequence. Another point, being suspended between heaven and earth also may symbolize his fate as a king is now very much in doubt. I kind of look at that a little different. I think the kingship was done. The battle's lost. He's obviously trying to go somewhere. So many of his men have fled that he's kind of out. And usually, like you would expect David's men, there was a loyal group that if David, they would have stayed with David till the bitter end. And it looks like Absalom's, the love and caring for Absalom was very, very surface level. That once things went bad, everybody's like, "Hey, every man for himself, good luck." And I kind of see that this is more of Absalom being suspended between heaven and earth is... He had a choice to make, heaven or Sheol, and his choice was Sheol. And that's where he ended up in a pit covered in rocks. So it's kind of symbolic. That's just how I took that.
And we never hear David retrieving his son.
Yeah. And then another point. One of Job's men has to remind him of David's plea to protect Absalom, a military term. David had said, "Deal gently." So, obviously, Absalom just, Joab, for good or for bad, just said, "Nah, that's not going to happen." Because it would always, I mean, you think about it. I mean, I understand we've seen David's point, but from Joab's point, I can't let this treason fester again. If we go easy with this, which we're going to see an example of, we're going to deal with this all the time. So I'm putting an end to this, whether David wants it or not. I'm putting an end to this. So Joab thrusting of three spears in the heart of Absalom employs the same verb as sounding the trumpet and contrasts his killing of Absalom with his sparing the troops. So he makes the point that by killing Absalom and blowing the trumpet, he's basically saying, "Let everybody flee. Don't pursue them. Let everybody go back." Because again, you know, in that type of civil war, then you know, you killed my brother, even though it was in war, now I'm obligated to kill you. This could just go on into perpetuity, and he's trying to see ahead and put the kingdom back together once this is over, and, you know, kind of goes back to remember what the Jews said of Jesus, better for one man to die than for all of us to be in trouble. So that's kind of the point that's being made here. I feel, again, this is all my speculation. If anybody has any other, like I said, I went and researched a little bit. I couldn't find anything. You know, everybody's making speculative statements. Nobody knows. So the pitiful heap of stones piled over Absalom's grave, though described as very great, hardly compares with his own massive monument to himself in the King's Valley, named in the next verse. So, again, Absalom's trying to prop himself off up when he's basically just going to be forgotten and literally put on the ash heap of history, and or the rock heap, I guess, would be a better, that, you know, it's a couple chapters here, he kind of ascends, and then he's gone. And that's, and throughout eternity and history, I guess as long as people are able to tell this story, he's going to be the bad example. So,
you and Janet drive, make her park the car while you walk in.
Alright, so I mean, I usually try to go through here and find a theme. I mean, this, it just has so many little pieces, I couldn't pull out a single theme, like the theme of like the hatred and how it's going to destroy you, and so I really don't know, other than, you know, there is a person trying to usurp the throne in your life, and it's either an external force or it's you. And the only way that the right king is going to sit on the throne is if you bury the usurper. And that's kind of what came out of this. And we're going to see an interesting continuation of this. And I wanted to make the point, I am not going to be here next week. So if somebody wants to, Mike, if you want to lead, Scott, whoever wants to do something, or you guys can take a break, it's a holiday weekend, whatever you guys want to do, you guys decide. And that being said, does anybody have any input? Anybody have anything? I mean, I basically just read all that. What's that? Yeah, at the pew. Anybody?
Yeah, I looked up Neil Jeffrey, and it says Jesus deals gently with all sinners who come to him regardless of their severity of their sin. And then in Hebrews 5:2, it's labeled qualifications for priesthood. It says, for every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men being things pertaining to God, that he may offer great gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subjected to weakness. Then, Psalm 103:13 says, as a father has compassion on his children, so God has compassion, fatherly compassion on those who fear him. So, looking at David's heart, he had a heart after God. God has compassion on all of us who are sinners. If you look at Absalom, we've all sinned
as
well, so his sins are
different. Right. I mean, obviously, they're no worse than David's.
Yeah, but David was called a man after God's heart. So the compassion for King Saul, or, you know what I'm saying, like, he didn't... take revenge or try to kill the anointed or, you know what I'm saying? He was being like God very far. So if I have to have compassion, it's a God far.
So I don't know. I don't. It's a weird dichotomy because you know that if Absalom had lived, it would have been trouble. Yeah, and we're going to kind of see that play out in the next couple chapters, even though he didn't live. What his shadow over the kingdom is. So.
And the Lord says, "Revenge is mine. I will repay."
Again, David's the king, and it should be his rules. But I think Joab's like, I'm not going to let this fester any further. And Joab gets his. When you'll realize when David's dead, he tells Solomon, take care of Joab, because he's been a ruthless man. So I don't know. I don't know what to do with that. Again, like I said, the problem with the Absalom thing is he never seems to have a heart of repentance, right? He went to his demise trying to be king, trying to sit on the throne that was not his.
Would that be
pride? Yep. And, I think we're all kind of trying to do that at times, sit on the thrones in our own lives, and it's going to leave nothing but destruction.
I think the verse that follows is pretty interesting, too, because, basically they say, hey, you love Absalom more than your people. And he did. And like any father, I'm sure, in the end, he wants his son to survive. So they're right to say, hey, now you made us all feel ridiculous because you love your enemy more than you love your friend.
Right. Agreed. And think of it. And besides, Absalom had killed the true heir to the throne. He was a murderer just like David. So, again, how much did David's sin cloud his own judgment? Or being able to deal with the situation? And we all, as parents, we've done a lot of bad things. Thank goodness the internet didn't exist and cell phones back then. But, and I've known people that can't deal with their kids because they're like, well, I did it. It's like, well, no, you had that experience, and now you can stop your kids from doing that. It's not the point, well, I can't stop them because I did it. That's the opposite of wisdom, I would think. So, all right, anybody want to pray to close this? We're good. Gary, how about you volunteer?
Sure.
You have the face of volunteerism.
Now, there you go. Lord, thank you for this time. We pray, Lord, for your words. You study, Lord, to show us enlightenment. Help us, Lord, to have a nugget, Lord, to take with us and use our lives. Pray also, Lord, now for our fellowship.
Amen.